Drilling fluids touch just about everything in the drilling process. We're here to deconstruct the drilling process and drilling fluid concepts to provide a deeper understanding of our industry. In each episode, we'll share information, talk to interesting people, and maybe share a few stories along the way. Welcome to The Flow Line, a production of AES Drilling Fluids, brought to you by Matt Offenbacher and Justin Gauthier.
All right, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of The Flow Line, here with my lovely co-host, as always, Mr. Matt Offenbacher. Matt, how you doing this lovely Monday morning?
I mean, doing pretty well, Justin. It's opening day week, so I know this is going to come out much later than that, but right now, in the moment, I'm excited for baseball. So
who do they play opening day?
The Mets.
And how's that looking? How's that shaping up?
Well, we don't even know the roster yet. Like, it's what? I'm just excited, you know, like, you know, it's the first game of 162, so, you know, of the regular season. So I'm just excited to be there.
Yeah, no kidding.
They could all be excited and wound up and we play like crap, which I'll be upset because, you know, it's my time and I need to see my team win.
Yeah.
But you know what?
Well,
it's baseball.
It is, and I'm really hoping Altuve can catch a pot fly in the outfield. I've seen some funny videos, and I don't know if they're just like owning in on like the two errors he made all spring or what. But
no, they've been pretty bad.
which it's funny. So speaking of that, so my birthday, my son bought me, or he got my wife to buy me the PlayStation to. The show 25.
Yeah.
So like the brand new MLB.
Oh, yeah.
It came out on Wednesday.
I know.
Like the 19th.
It's all the rage.
Oh, man. It's, and so they actually have Altuve playing left field. And he hasn't dropped a ball yet on the game. It's a blast. It's a good time. So we only allow sport games for our PlayStation because my son, he'll play it and I get bored.
Yeah.
Instead of like Fortnite where he'd probably play for like 12 hours straight. But in saying all of that, man, they've got the Astros balling on the show 25. So hopefully it's a sign of good things to come.
I sure hope so. It's exciting. It's a lot of change, but it's exciting.
Yeah. Is there, I remember last year there were some rule changes. Is there more rule changes this year or is it just about the same?
No. You know, I should know this, but at least in spring training, they tested the appeal process for balls and strikes. So it was down in the minors, but I don't think that will officially get adopted in the major leagues yet. I think it was just a trial to work its way up to the majors.
Interesting.
But, you know, you disagree with what the umpire says, you tap your helmet, they do a computer review, and if you, I think you get two of them. If you win your appeal, you don't lose your appeal.
Oh,
you don't lose it, but
yeah.
Anyways.
So the batter has an opportunity to appeal the ball or a strike. Really?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You would think at this point with the way technology is that within like a second of a pitch, it'd be able to, because like on the screen, sometimes they have the square, that the umpire would have an earpiece and that he doesn't even have to call balls and strikes anymore. It would be computer generated and there would just be like, bump, and at least you'd have the like people there to, you know, or like the umpire there for novelty, but do you even need an umpire anymore?
Well, there's there's a huge argument with these umpires that play these terrible, that call these terrible games and can't seem to get fired, like maybe. Maybe not, I guess, but it's kind of one of those. I think some people want it for the sake of the game, and like even umpires aren't perfect, but there's a thing on Twitter you can follow called Umpire Scorecards, and what they will do is they'll evaluate the umpire, but it's by their consistency. So it's like, are they, you know, was it an actual ball or a strike, and how often do they call it a ball or a strike?
Sure.
So. I've never had an issue if, you know, look, the umpire gives you inside is going to be a strike. It's a little off the plate, but everybody knows that after going to seeing a few people at bat.
Right.
And both teams are treated the same.
Yeah.
What's awful is when nobody knows and you're like, well, I guess I got to swing because I don't know what he's going to do with this. And I think that sort of undermines the competition. So,
yeah,
I mean, robo umps would be kind of interesting. You know, there's still other judgment calls that have to be made.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating. We'll see. I'm sure if it goes away, I'll be like, oh man, they're changing the game. But
yeah, I mean, as I wouldn't say I'm a purist, but as a purist sports fan, you know, for the love of the game, it would having everything digitized and just automated kind of takes away from like the element of just sometimes you leave up to chance and luck.
Yeah.
And because it can really sway a game. And it just it creates, I think, a unique story if you do still have the human element calling games instead of it just being like robotic. I think it would be. But nonetheless, it's just it's an interesting topic. But the appeal piece for Balls and Strikes is kind of neat. It'd be interesting to see how that plays out. But anyway, moving on to Drilling Fluids, folks. Thanks for hanging in there for a little baseball chat. As always, we're going to be getting into that good stuff here for the next few months. So be ready, or just know that you have to fast forward about 5 minutes to get to Drilling Fluids topics. But either way, both are fun. More importantly, for today's discussion, Matt, something we've talked about in the past, but again, I think revisiting certain topics is always important to dive a little deeper or cover some things we may not have in the first one. But today we're going to talk about corrosion, one that, you know, is important without any bit of corrosion control, considering, you know, most of the parts on a rig are metal. You know, having good corrosion is important, but understanding sort of the mechanisms, how things corrode, how to prevent it is extremely important. And, you know, by now, considering we've drilled, you know, tens of thousands of wells in the U.S., we have a pretty good idea on how to manage it, but it can't be overlooked. So why don't we dive into that today, what do you think?
It's a good one. I mean, there's rust everywhere on a rig, and what do we do to keep from losing all our metal? Pipe is still expensive, right? We still have a lot of these conversations, and there's other ways for it to fail, but corrosion could be one of several factors that could lead it to fail earlier.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and without a good corrosion prevention program, could lead to some costly mistakes. But I think to get started, let's describe and to share to the audience like how stuff actually begins to corrode or rust.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus on kind of the iron corrosion, which I think is mostly what we'd recognize with drill pipe and other things. We have had conversations in the past of, you know, corrosion associated with mud motor stators and rotors, that kind of thing. But for here, we're going to talk about how rust is made. In one. I think big overlying theme that has helped me is, you know, you hear that story of how things want to get to their most like basic energy state, like the lowest energy state. So what happens? You go dig up iron ore out of the side of a mountain, then you smelt it. You put all of this energy in, right, to organize all of the structure of steel, basically to make that steel. And right now, so then it's in this high order energy state, and all it wants to do is go back to the way it was, right? So it wants to go back to that lower level of energy, and this is the process of how steel goes back to sort of its origin.
Oh, okay. So it's an interesting way to think about it.
And you know, the other thing is you have to keep in mind that steel, a new piece of drill pipe may look perfect, but it actually has a ton of imperfections in it. And that is where we end up getting these dissimilar areas where you can have sort of a circuit. And this is, so you have an anode and a cathode. And you have to have your pipe, we're in water or some electrolyte. Iron dissolves in water at the anode. And then at the cathode, you have electrons and hydrogen gas that gets released. And then you've got oxygen, water, and electrons, you know, these hydroxyl groups forming. Guess what? So you had your iron available. I mentioned oxygen, hydrogen. What is rust begin? FeOH2, iron hydroxide. And then, you know, you end up with some species of iron oxide, Fe3O4 or whatever. Basically, it's this conductive path. So you've got this circuit going on.
Right.
And so another great helpful metaphor is when we want to control it, which we'll jump down to here in a bit. Is if you can break the circuit. So sometimes I've seen people use it like a battery where, you know, you need to turn off a switch so that cycle of electrons being released can't happen.
Yeah.
So that's rust.
Okay. No, that's good. That's, I think, you know, again, it's obviously something, that you learn in, you know, grade 5 chemistry perhaps, but, you know, again, unless you've sort of touched on it over the years, you tend to need to refresh the memory. So let's go into the factors that affect corrosion.
Well, for corrosion to take place, one way to get iron soluble, right? We talk about solubility all the time, and at high pH, some things are insoluble, and at low pH, some things are soluble. Well, low pH, you're in an acidic environment. That's a great way to solubilize iron. So if you're in an acidic environment, your pH, it can play a big factor. It's one of the reasons that when we talk about best practices with water-based drilling fluid, we normally say, hey, keep it above 9 if you can. And granted, even at least keep it above neutral. Of course, there's always a yeah, but. So when we talk about drilling really reactive surface formations, we want to keep our pH low so we don't cause clays to swell and that kind of thing. So there's always the yeah, but generally once we get, if we don't have an exception case, keep the pH above 9 if you can. And remember, pH is logarithmic, which means 9 is a lot more than 8.5.
Right.
So, you know, that's one. Acid gases, I mean, one, acid gases lower the pH. The other thing is oxygen is an acid. Oxygen is a gas. So we entrain air in our drilling fluid or allow air to get into it. And we mentioned how oxygen is part of the process there for corrosion earlier on. So one way to mitigate corrosion is to take the oxygen away. You know, an interesting one. So I was in my homework, I was trying to look at some like best practices from a few corrosion control experts. And they mentioned conductivity, right? And conductivity is important because conductive path that facilitates corrosion.
Yeah.
Here is where something I think it's a little, I don't know, controversial. So like a more saline solution is going to be more conductive, right?
Right.
However, my general observation is most of your corrosion is when you have like 3 or 4% by weight sodium chloride or something, brackish salinity.
Mm.
However, your fluid may be more conductive at saturation, let's say 10-pound sodium chloride, but you have way less dissolved oxygen in saturated brine. So
okay,
taking
I see where you're going with it. Yeah.
Oxygen out can actually, like, you may see a lower corrosion rate. So you see, like,
yeah,
there's some sweet spot there where it's the worst.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So it rolls over a little bit on how. Once you get to a certain point, if you are fully saturated with no dissolved oxygen, it gets bad to a point, but then it actually gets better once
yes.
you kind of reach that past that point. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I remember actually going through that battle with a customer several years ago.
Well, it's, I mean, what's so interesting to it for me is like, because it makes sense. Like you think salt water, you think rust.
Yeah.
And then you get to like, well, we drill a saturated brine and I don't see the problem necessarily as much. And it's like, well, right. But if you're drilling with 3% KCl, it's probably way worse. Right. So just there's some tension there. The other stuff is a little more so. Temperature, guess what? Faster reactions, more corrosive, right? Like chemical reactions happen faster at higher temperatures. This was another one I came across in my homework that I agree with, so I thought I'd bring it up. Is just pipe stress. So
right.
The amount you're working the pipe, that kind of thing, and. When you think of steel, what a lot of people don't realize is that's actually like a crystalline structure. So metal is a crystalline structure. So when you put it under stress, you have these gaps in the lattice. You have, you know, a lot more areas where those imperfections can become pronounced and create that concentration cellar or that corrosion path. Yeah. And then another one that comes up that is just fluid velocity. And so an element of corrosion that I think people sometimes overlook is just... the erosion corrosion, as they call it, but it's effectively abrasion, like wearing away the metal, which if you think about it, you have something that rusts, you circulate, that rust comes off, you have new, fresh, exposed area that can rust. You know, you can over time wear away the metal. So, those aren't all the factors. It's not an exhaustive list, but I think it's something to sort of get us going, to think through how we stop corrosion by looking at some of the sources.
Right. Well, and that kind of leads perfectly into the next segment is now that we've sort of identified the factors and what causes it, there's a good number of sort of control mechanisms and things we can do to help prevent. So let's kind of start at the very basic and then we'll move in from there.
Yeah. So first and foremost, like I said, you know, think of that path and break it. So how do we stop some of these things from happening? Well, one, you could make it non-conductive. So let's say you have corrosion's a real bear somewhere. oil-based mud, not conductive, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, we've already mentioned raising the pH, so limiting the solubility of that, of, you know, ions such that because they're not going into solution, you don't have that cycle.
Right. And real quick, it's, you know, it's sounds obvious, but like when we say raise the pH, we're speaking water-based mud.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Because I've had people ask, what's the pH of oil-based mud? That has happened before. And so, but anyway, yeah, on the pH side, for those perhaps are maybe new to the mud side of things, when you're referencing pH ranges, it's with water-based mud.
Yes. And then there are, this is one, I feel like sometimes when I talk to corrosion control experts, they're like, oh, you need a filming inhibitor. So get something that coats all the pipe so that you can't have that conductive pass. So basically like an oil wetting agent. I find that generally in a dynamic environment, AKA when I am circulating, these don't really hold up. It can be effective for like pipe storage, or let's say you're using a packer fluid where the fluid is going to remain static and you're just trying to protect the production tubing. There's an argument about using filming inhibitors while drilling, and the fear is if you have an uneven coverage of that filming inhibitor, that'll actually make the corrosion even worse because you've created just this one isolated spot.
Okay.
And I will say that I think some of this stuff's pretty nasty too. And so you don't see it used very often.
Okay.
And then we mentioned limiting oxygen. So there's a couple of things you can do here. I mean, hearkening back to episodes we've done on defoamers, right? Just like, what are all the ways that I get air in my system? Close the hopper, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So keep it from getting in. And then what is getting in, you can add scavengers, and you can actually measure how much dissolved oxygen is present. Or if you're using something like ammonium bisulfite, which is a very common, cheap corrosion inhibitor, there's a kit called an excess sulfite kit.
Right.
And the idea is you can measure, and if you have excess sulfites at the flow line, because they react with oxygen to form sulfate, if you have sulfites available, it means you've scavenged all the oxygen, in theory, right? Because some remaining. So that can be another way. And I don't suggest necessarily making a lifestyle of checking those things, but if you are in an area where you're really trying to nail down your corrosion control program, I would monitor this for a while until you feel like you're in the driver's seat again.
Right.
So our acid gases. I think it's really obvious that we don't want like H2S around. CO2 is something we encounter a lot. And, you know, one thing we've talked about with like carbonates versus bicarbonates is sort of how to treat those things, making sure that you aren't in that acid gas range with CO2. And then, I mean, you can scavenge CO2 as well. It's not cheap. So if it comes to it, that can also be an option for you. And then if you, once again, with sort of the carbonate environment, especially, there's risk of forming scale in your pipe. So you're in an alkaline environment. You might have some lime scale. You can have some other forms of scale that form. And those sort of create that, you know, anode cathode imperfection, when it starts to coat things and provide that uneven coating, it can sort of accelerate things and make them worse. So there are additives that will actually limit that crystal structure from forming. So you'll add them as part of your corrosion control program, and they will limit the ability for that stuff to sort of precipitate and form a structure that'll form on your pipe. So that's a very common thing that we do a lot in West Texas.
Right.
So you'll normally, and it'll be blended with some other additives, right? So a lot of times you'll have a mixture of a couple, it does a couple of different things. A lot of times you'll have an H2S scavenger just because we encounter it a lot there.
Yeah.
And that H2S scavenger also does some things to control bacteria, which is my next bullet point.
Okay.
So bacteria has a tendency as it consumes things. One, I mean, it's going to eat all your mud additives, so you probably don't want it there.
Right.
But if you have some, it will have a tendency to cause your pH to drop. A lot of those biogenic processes will release either CO2 or H2S. So kill the bugs, protect your mud, keep things from getting out of hand. And then the last one, I don't know how careful we are when the pipe comes out of the hole. mm-hmm. to actually get it cleaned up. I mean, we're pulling as fast as we can.
Yeah, they have. So. I mean, most of the time, you've got your strippers on the drill pipe as it's coming out. So for the most part, you'll strip the mud off of the drill pipe. But those can get worn out, and then you may have quite a bit of mud still left on there, just, you know, drying out when it's racked back. And then internally, it's not like you flush the drill pipe, right? You still probably have mud more so on the inside than the outside. But it's a good sort of, it's an interesting sort of way to think about it is, you know, any mud left on the pipe, if it's sitting out there up in the derrick, you know, just could possibly lead to accelerating the corrosion. I mean,
yeah, well, and I mean, I've seen more serious cases where they'll actually either wipe or dip the stands of pipe or joints of pipe in a bath of like a filming material to keep them, to help preserve them. It is one of those, you can try and wash off the exterior and try and do some of these things to limit the amount of residual salt that hangs out on there.
Yeah.
I know when I was helping support some work in the Gulf of Mexico and they were doing a lot of stuff with calcium chloride brine, they all of a sudden started having corrosion issues, and it was basically just, they were just racking back the pipe and it had all that brine residue on it, and really went to town on their drill pipe. So, there was a lot of conversations about what can we do to limit that. And a lot of it was just like rinse off the pipe. Don't let a bunch of salt hang out on there.
Yeah. Very basic, but over the long run, that could be helpful.
Yeah.
Even
absolutely.
Something as simple as just rinsing the pipe off. When we look at, for corrosion control, I think it's important, and you have it referenced, is just like understanding the fundamentals of like the cause and then what you can do. And so it's just kind of tying it all together, Matt. How would you sort of summarize that?
If you have a control corrosion problem, figure out the source. So I think that, there are a lot of different ways to do that. Most of them are very obvious.
Yeah.
It is under treatment with your corrosion control additives, not using them at all. Sometimes it could be some special thing you're encountering, but a lot of times that could be as simple as, hey, I saw some weird shape colored scale. Well, get us a sample. Let's get to the lab because depending on what it's composed of, I can tell you exactly where that corrosion came from.
Right.
So finding the source and then addressing it versus trying 18 things at once and kind of wondering what happened. And then, corrosion control, we've talked about it in the past, have a good corrosion monitoring program, especially, I know that behaviorally, if we don't have a problem for a while, we stop looking at these things, but get a handle on where you're at in your environment and how things look using corrosion rings, using them properly, minimum 40 hours, maximum of 100 downhole, keep track of them.
Yeah.
A lot of times we miss those basics. We're not doing the monitoring, and then everybody wonders what happens, and it was this really expensive mess that we made. So there's a number of different ways to just sort of keep an eye on those things. Our brethren to the north, because they use calcium chloride, and it's such a serious challenge for a lot of what they do, there are probes now, the electrode probes you can leave in the brine in a pit and have wires just going straight into the EDR, giving you real-time measurements on corrosion properties, dissolved oxygen, that sort of thing. There's a lot more ways to go about this and get some hard data and know where you stand and where you stood when you had a problem.
Yeah.
The last thing, this has just come up a few times, and I wanted to address it because a lot of our additives for corrosion control don't like cations. So what this means is you have an oxygen scavenger and you're running really high hardness. You neutralize the oxygen scavenger. You neutralize some of the other corrosion inhibitor package.
Yeah.
Once again, our brethren to the north, they have special additives specifically to deal with high calcium environments because of calcium chloride, because of some of these things. And, I've just, I know it can be tempting, especially with brine. We've talked about having these out of whack alkalinities where you can just let things go and, oh, it's just brine, who cares? And then find yourself in a real problem because, like, it doesn't work with your lubricant.
Yeah.
I know there are some lubricants that they say, hey, run the hardness really high. And you can do that, but you probably need to switch additives. They cost more money. People aren't going to like it, but you may, in fact, by slipping up on these things, you may be neutralizing your corrosion control program. And that may not be something that costs you on this well, but it will cost you. So I think just be mindful of those things is, like, are my additives compatible with the fluid I'm running?
Right.
And a lot of that is sticking to a mud program or changing my additives if I know I'm going to go loose.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and a lot of the, I mean, again, a lot of the chemistry that's out there is tried and true. And so I don't see you're anticipating any sort of like major breakthroughs in corrosion control because I think we've got a pretty good handle on it. But again, if it's overlooked and isn't managed properly, then it can be an issue. But yeah, again, kind of like Matt alluded to, is just like, you know, focus on the fundamentals of identifying how it can happen and use the best practices that you know work. And the rest should be all good. And so with that being said, you know, I don't have any other questions. Matt, anything else? Any crazy stories or something wild that you'd like to share with
something them? Wild. Well, if you know me well enough, you know, there's not a lot wild going on over here. But
well, hopefully you don't have a wild catastrophe with corrosion.
And no.
Then you're going to be in good shape.
Exactly.
So, well, with that said, folks, if you have any thoughts, questions, reach out to Matt or I on LinkedIn is probably the best way, or you can reach us at the Flowline Podcast at AESFluids.com. Be sure to subscribe, share, review, and you know, connect with the AES Fluids page on LinkedIn. There's a lot of great content being put out. Same thing with the YouTube channel. Again, we just continue to put out amazing content for, you know, more so educating than anything. And if you have any good ideas for a show, please let us know. If you have any just questions with regards to drilling fluid or drilling operations, we'd love to tackle them. And with that said, everyone, take care for now. Be safe. Cheers.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. Please tune in next week for another exciting episode of The Flowline. And remember, may your returns always be full and your trips always smooth. Views expressed in this program belong to participants and not their employees. The program is for informational purposes only and cannot take the place of seeking professional advice. Copyright AES Drilling Fluids.